It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Going to do an investigation into Christianity, where would you start?
If the resurrection of Jesus didn't happen, it's a house of cards.
You sure you want to give me that loaded gun?
I'm pretty sure you're not going to be able to pull the trigger.
I've spent my entire career as a journalist uncovering the truth until the day my wife presented me with the biggest story of my life.
I'm not going to lose my wife and my kids to something that I can't even reason with.
And what happened next changed me forever.
How can we even talk about historical evidence for the resurrection?
The Gospels are filled with contradictions.
The empty tomb is based on evidence. And isn't evidence your trade?
We all bet our lives on something.
The question is, what's it going to be?
As much as I would like to help out a fellow skeptic, what you're proposing is impossible.
Could Jesus survive being spiked to the cross?
There is no evidence of anyone ever surviving a full Roman crucifixion.
Just because I write something down and I bury it in the dirt, it doesn't make it true.
What I felt was something more real than anything I've ever felt in my life.
I'm praying for you.
Do you really want to know the truth, or is your mind already made up?
Stop blaming me and the church and God and do your job.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. That's the trailer for a movie that many of you have seen, but not everyone. It's called The Case for Christ. It came out in April of this year, and imagine my surprise when I went to the movie and saw that it was a story of the life of someone I've known for a long time and admired. And his name is Lee Strobel. The book, by the way, was written back in 1998, which is around the time I think I first met Lee. And he was an investigative reporter at the Chicago Tribune. We were in Chicago, and Lee's life had transformed. It was kind of a story that we all knew at Willow Creek, which was our home church. And out of that dramatic conversion that God did in Lee's life, he began a work that probably Lee could never have imagined, and none of us could have. Lee is a former investigative journalist, as I said, for the Chicago Tribune. He's a graduate of Yale Law School, also a graduate of the University of Missouri, and he's the author of so many wonderful books that really probably are the reason that many of you have heard of him, from The Case for Faith, A Case for a Creator, Case for the Real Jesus, and on it goes. And so Lee joins us. I'm absolutely delighted to talk to him today. Lee, thanks for joining us.
Oh, Sandy, it's so great to talk with you. It's been a while.
It's been a long time. And, you know, I have to be practical here, because not only is the movie fabulous, but people are going to be able to buy it. They already can, as of August 15th, buy this combo pack, Blu-ray, DVD, and digital HD. It's produced by Pure Flix, and you can buy it now and watch it in your home. And I just can't say enough about the movie. You know what, Lee? What was it like to watch yourself? It wasn't really you, I know, but watch somebody playing your life on the screen. What was that like?
Well, you know, honestly, a lot of it was embarrassing, because I'm not proud of the way I lived my life before I was a Christian. I mean, I was a hard-drinking, narcissistic, immoral-living atheist at Chicago Tribune. And but, you know, when we made the movie, we thought we have to be honest about the good and the bad. And if we pulled our punches and soft-pedaled some of what I was like, then people would see through that. So as uncomfortable as that is, we decided to present the evidence and our lives as we lived them. And so it's a little bit uncomfortable. It's funny, Leslie, my wife, watched the movie 10 times on our computer before it released in theaters. And I asked her, why do you keep watching it? And she said, I'm trying to get cried out. I want to get cried out so when I see it in public, I won't embarrass myself by crying. But of course she did. So
you know what? Well, that kind of answers the question, Lee, because that says to me that you both felt it was a good representation of your experience. Of course, nothing can be exactly accurate, but it must have been a very strong, powerful representation of what you experienced.
Yeah, it really is. You know, of course, when you take a 2-year period of a marriage and spiritual investigation and compress that into a 90-minute movie, you're going to have to do some time shifting and some composite characters and so forth. But honestly, the movie is about 85% accurate, and some of the scenes are just so right out of our lives that it's chilling for us to sit there and watch them.
Were you involved deeply in the process, like the day-to-day, and watching scenes and making comments?
You know, it was a really fun process. We sat down with Brian Bird, who was a screenwriter, and spent a week with him, really giving him the lowdown on our life and the details of our marriage. And then we met with the people who were going to portray us in the film. We kind of had approval over the characters, the cast, who were going to be playing us. We went to the set. We prayed with the crew and cast every day, even though a lot of them weren't Christians, but they all participated. Had a lot of great spiritual conversations along the way. So we were quite involved. It was fun because they rebuilt the movie takes place in 1980, and so we recreated the 1980 Chicago Tribune newsroom on a soundstage in Georgia. And it was so weird to walk onto that set, and it was like a time machine. It was like you're all of a sudden transported back to 1980. It was so accurate. It was chilling.
Let me just say that Mike Vogel played you, and of course, he didn't look just like you, Lee, but I did think that he was very convincing. And Erica Christensen, too, was wonderful.
They really were. They did a great job. In fact, I don't know if you know this, but Mike Vogel, who played me, is the new star of a NBC series that premieres this fall on Monday nights called The Brave.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so he's kind of got a great opportunity to be the star of a network TV show. So we're really proud of him, and he's a strong Christian and had read my book as a teenager, and it helped him in his faith. So it was great to have him in the film. And, of course, Faye Dunaway is in the movie, and she had been actually looking for a faith-based film to be in because her faith has kind of come alive in recent years.
Really?
And she was actually seeking a faith-based movie to be part of. The sad part was a week before her filming her scene, she broke her ankle real severely.
Oh.
And but you know, she's a Hollywood trooper. She said, "I'm coming. I'm going to do the scene." And so we had to rewrite the scene so she could sit the whole time. And during the break, she had to elevate her ankle and have it massaged. She was in a lot of pain, but God bless her. She showed up and did her job.
Well, you know, it's funny because I was going to ask you, did you ever think that when you saw Bonnie and Clyde, and I know you did, or the Thomas Crown Affair, that Faye Dunaway would play in a movie about your life?
I know, it's so bizarre. It is really bizarre. You just never anticipated. But, you know, our attitude was a lot of people won't read a 300-page book. They won't come to a church, but they'll go to a movie, or they'll rent a movie, or watch a DVD. And so we thought, you know, if we can reach more people with this message of hope and grace through Christ, then it's all worth it.
What did you like personally after you got, you know, any time those of us that have public life, whatever it is we do, the first time you hear your own voice, you cringe. The first time you see yourself on camera, you cringe. Once you got past that, what did you like best, Lee?
Well, you know, it's so fun to watch the movie because it just kind of unfolds our life. And it's like, you know, there are certain things that took place in our marriage that I only knew about or that Leslie only knew about because the other one of us wasn't there, but it's portrayed in the movie. And so we get to see things in our marriage that the other spouse has only told us about. So it's kind of odd in that it kind of fleshes out a lot of our relationship in a way that's totally unexpected.
Well, I want to tell you my favorite parts because one of the things that really struck me, and when we were friends in Chicago, you always spoke so lovingly of Leslie, always, Lee. Yeah. There was always such love in your voice. And that the relationship, the way it was portrayed in the movie, in spite of the difficulty, there was a commitment between you, that the both of you, that really came through. And I just thought, you know, how many movies do you see like that, or television shows, where people are so committed to each other?
Yeah, you know, it's a good point. These days, it seems like that's a rare thing. But the fact that Mike Vogel and Erica Christensen had been in a couple other previous movies, and so they knew each other really well, and so they were very comfortable with each other as kind of a couple in the movie. That really contributed to the easygoing nature of our relationship portrayed on the screen. But you know, it was really Leslie's fidelity, her persistence, the fact that she loved me even though I wasn't very lovable at the time, that she stuck by me, that she kept praying for me. Really was the key, I think, to this whole spiritual journey.
Yeah. The other thing I really liked about the movie, I loved seeing you with long hair and a mustache and 70s clothes. That was fun.
Well, you know, I did have the long hair. I never was able to grow the mustache, so that was kind of artistic license there.
Oh, all right.
In the movie, I got to drive a really cool a Camaro. That was fun.
Yes, you did. That's true. Now, and the other thing that I really loved, I love the scene where you finally come to Christ. And the reason I love it, Lee, because, you know, unlike you, I came to Christ when I was 9 years old, dramatically, but young. And I never lost that passion. Never lost it. But I've seen a lot of Christian movies, of course. But I love the scene where you come to Christ because it was so honest and real. I love the way that came through.
You know, I'll tell you, when we filmed it, it was filmed in a house in Georgia, and Leslie and I were outside watching on a video monitor as they were filming that scene. And I was literally holding my breath because God did something in that scene. I mean, it was so real. It was so authentic. It was so raw that I was just holding my breath that something wouldn't happen. And then an airplane started to fly over the house, and I thought, oh, no, the sound is going to ruin the scene. But it didn't, unfortunately. But, yeah, I mean, the honesty with which Mike portrays that moment of coming to faith, as you say, it can be really cheesy in some films, and because it's really hard to portray something as intimate and as personal as that in an authentic way. But I thought Mike just did a masterful job of being honest with it. And, you know, I think the fact that he is a believer probably contributed to the authenticity of that scene. So we were thrilled with how it came out.
Yeah, I just have to say, to come back to just people listening, I think there's no formula in coming to Christ, and there are no right words. There's no three steps. There's no a certain prayer. It is really a surrender, a recognition of the power of God, and a recognition of who Jesus is, and a repentance. And it comes out in different ways in different people. And it can be eloquent, and it can be not so eloquent. It doesn't have to be. And so I just think that point you brought home beautifully, and I just wanted to underscore it. Now, as you watch the movie, is there anything that you now would do differently?
I don't think so. I mean, it's so well done. And again, I'm not taking credit for it because I didn't do it. I mean, it was PureFlix that did it. I just think they did it so well. I'll tell you a funny thing that happened toward the end.
Can you hold that thought, Lee? Because we're going to have to take a break here. So hold on. We'll come back with Lee Strobel. He's our guest. By the way, The Case for Christ is available now for you to purchase through Blu-ray Video. And it's being made available by PureFlix. They're the producers of the movie. And you'll want to get this because it's just a great movie. I can't wait to watch it again myself. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with the author, Lee Strobel, of The Case for Christ. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
I I was an atheist for much of my life. I thought that the idea of God was absurd. I thought that God didn't create people, but people created God because they were afraid of death. And so they manufactured this idea of this benevolent jelly bean in the sky, you know, make himself feel better when they die, that sort of thing. And so I lived a life that was consistent with that and sort of made up my morality as I went and fell into some narcissistic and self-destructive kind of behaviors as a result. My wife was more in spiritual neutral, sort of agnostic, didn't quite know what to believe. She met a neighbor who was a Christian who shared her faith with her. My wife kind of checked it out over many months and decided to become a follower of Christ, which I thought was the worst possible news I could get. You know, I thought she was going to turn into some sexually repressed prude or something, you know, was going to spend all her time on Skid Row serving the poor or something. It's not what I signed up for, and I was going to walk out on her. But I stuck around and began to see positive changes in her character and values and the way she related to me and the kids. And it was winsome and it was attractive. And so one day she invited me to church and I went. And I heard the message of Jesus explained in a way I could understand. And I didn't believe it yet, but I realized this is really important if it's true.
That's the voice of the real Lee Strobel giving his testimony, and I wanted you to hear that because then the movie, of course, The Case for Christ, which is based on Lee's book, which was written in 1998, the movie came out in 2017, April of this year, and my husband and I enjoyed it thoroughly, and it's now out in Blu-ray. It's a combo pack, DVD, digital, HD, and you can get it at a store, and you will enjoy it so very much, and Lee is our guest, by the way. God grew him up to be a great author and a great speaker and a pastor. But before that, Lee had another life, and I'm going to get into that in just a second, but we interrupted him because, Lee, you were telling us about something that happened at the end of the movie.
What was that? We were filming the last scenes, and it was in the newsroom of the Chicago Tribune, and John Gunn, who was a director, said, "Hey, Lee, you're not in the movie. You need to be in the movie." And I said, "Well, I'm not an actor." He said, "Yeah, that's all right. We're going to stick you in the background." So he stuck me in the newsroom working on an article. And so toward the end of the movie, there's a scene in which my boss is bawling me out in his office off the newsroom. And through the Venetian blinds, looking into the newsroom, there I am working on a typewriter writing. So I'm sort of a Where's Waldo thing. Nobody's going to see me unless they know me. They know that I'm there.
Well, your kids know, Leslie knows, and now we know.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, Lee, as I mentioned, and we've alluded to it already, you had a very successful career before God saved you dramatically and changed your life thoroughly, which I got a chance to see firsthand. It's a marvelous thing. But before that, you were an investigative journalist at the award-winning Chicago Tribune. Was a great newspaper. And I want to talk about this for a second. You are a newsman, and so I know you watch the news. And you know that's what I do, it's the news. And you graduated from the University of Missouri. Did you graduate from the School of Journalism there?
Yes.
You know, it's world-renowned. I don't need to tell you, but I'm telling other people.
It's actually the first journalism school in the country.
Yes, and so that's what makes it sad, what I'm about to tell you, if you don't know. I just read an article this morning, not knowing that it would relate to you and I speaking. But, you know, there was such a problem at the University of Missouri in October 2015 with all this student protesting and racism and all of this. And Melissa Click, who threatened, gave a veiled threat to one of the reporters that was trying to film the thing. But this is what's happened. Classes just began this week. Freshman enrollment is down 35% since the protests. Missouri is beginning the year with the smallest incoming class since 1999. Overall enrollment is down by more than 2,000 students. The campus has taken 7 dormitories out of service. Their football season drew almost 13,000 fewer attendees than 2015. And on and on it goes. But the first part of the article talks about it quotes a lot of graduates of having removed their support and just completely turning their back on Missouri. And I know that has to be sad for a graduate like you who has taken rightful pride in graduating from Missouri. But really what I want to ask you about is the state of journalism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's you talk about sad. I mean, back when I was at the University of Missouri studying journalism, we were taught to be neutral observers, to kind of You know, we all have biases, we all have a perspective, but we're taught to tell both sides in a fair and balanced way. And when I was at Chicago Tribune, I was very liberal. I was pro-abortion, and I covered a lot of abortion cases because I covered the court system, and a lot of them ended up before the Supreme Court and so forth. But if you read any of my stories on the abortion issue, you would not have been able to tell where I personally stood, because I was taught you keep your personal sentiments out of the news and you report as thoroughly and as accurate as you can both sides of the issue. Well, that's all fallen by the wayside now. Now we have advocacy journalism where people don't even pretend to tell both sides of the story, and where a lot of journalists don't think the other side of the story is worth telling or important to tell. So I really fear for the future of journalism in America. We're going through an era where, if we lose the credibility of the press any further, this has ramifications in terms of our democracy. The First Amendment is there to protect a free and a vibrant press because it does play such an important role in our democracy. And I'm fearful for what's going to happen as we continue to slip into more advocacy journalism. Now, when I did my spiritual investigation as an atheist, investigating Christianity, I approached it like I did back then I would approach a big story. So I tried to be like an umpire in a baseball game and call a ball and a strike and just let the chips fall where they may. And that was important because I reached a conclusion in my investigation that I did not anticipate and did not want to reach that conclusion that Christianity was true. So, yeah, I'm like you, Sandy, I mourn for what the state of journalism in America, and I'm concerned that what's happening today is, if I wrote a controversial article for the Chicago Tribune, it would go through a series of editors who would question me, what are your sources, how do you know, what documents do you have, and they would make sure that whatever they published was backed up by evidence. Nowadays, with so many websites and blogs and so forth that don't have that kind of screening, what happens is it's now incumbent on us as the readers to do that kind of screening. So when you read an article, you have to ask yourself, do I trust this article? What are the sources that are mentioned? Are they biased? Are they anonymous? Why are they not listed? Does this tell both sides? And most people are not qualified or trained to do that kind of analysis of an article. So we're in tough weeds as a country in terms of where our press is at.
Yeah, Lee, I'd be curious to know what the rules were. Maybe they weren't written, I don't know, but the code of ethics, when it came to like citing unnamed sources and things, off the record statements or insiders, what I'm saying, huge cases of condemnation have been made on the basis of unnamed sources and, there has to be some sort of a rule for that.
Yeah, it changed in about 1973, 1974. Right when I was in journalism school, because of the Watergate investigation by Woodward and Bernstein, where they were citing a lot of anonymous sources. And this was rather new at the time. And newspapers and news outlets were very conservative back then in terms of allowing that. So in other words, you had to have a good reason why your source was not going to be named. And you would have to disclose your source to your editor. So I would have to say, okay, here's who my source is. This is the reason I can't name that source. And they would make a judgment on whether or not it was okay to do based on who the source is and the reason for not being disclosed publicly. Nowadays, it's become so loosey-goosey that people use anonymous sources all the time without that kind of scrupulous attention to the reasons why. And, there are instances where it is okay and it is appropriate to use anonymous sources because there are things being reported that, for whatever reason, would be damaging to that individual if he were known. But it's a lot rarer than we think. And right now, the anonymous sources are being thrown around in such a way that they do great damage to people without, I don't think, as much scrutiny and scrupulous attention as they used to get.
I don't know. I'm sure you did as much as you could keep up with the last election. And of course, those email that were leaked or not leaked. That's not true, really. The email of John Podesta and others that some thought WikiLeaks published them. So we can say that. it, one of the trails of information there was that all of these press persons, editors, writers, television reporters, news people were regularly having meetings and meals with the campaign director for Hillary Clinton, John Podesta.
Yeah.
And they were talking about how to help her get elected. They were going back and forth. I mean, what's the rule for that, Lee?
Yeah, I mean, it's totally inappropriate. You know, I think a lot of reporters get compromised because they really want to be the political powerhouse. They want to have the political influence. And so they get curried to by the political class, and their views are solicited, and they become ingratiated with the people that they're supposed to be covering. Which is why I never attended the Washington White House Correspondents' Dinner, which I think is a ridiculous and totally inappropriate event where the press comes and mingles with all the powerhouse politicians in this informal setting. I just think it's totally inappropriate. I mean, I am as a journalist, my role was to hold people accountable, and I can't hold them accountable if I'm drinking champagne with them. So I find that schmoozing and the crossing the lines between reporting and advocacy and consulting to be very troubling.
Yes, I do too, and I have found the same thing in Washington. I have to be careful about my friendships with congressmen, senators,
mm-hmm.
Because I can't. I am not. It's very hard then. To be objective when I try to explain to people when they make bad decisions, and I just can't find it in me. It's hard for me because I can't find it in me to cover when I think things are wrong. I just so then I make enemies. So it's better for me to stay away. And I think that's.
Yeah, I mean, I was known as a document rat, which meant I was a someone who pursued documents. I would spend hours and hours in archives looking for documents and. A lot of my major stories that I broke through the years didn't come from sources that I was drinking with. They came from hours of work plowing through documents and archives, looking for leads and looking for evidence.
You know, that brings up another point. I think one of the weaknesses in journalism, Lee, it's not just, it is in addition to all we've talked about, the fact that young reporters just have no, they're not doing the hard work you just described. And and they also have no historic knowledge. They don't understand it or know history. I was just reading the list of books that are being given as summer reading to colleges and universities, to their students, incoming students. And amazingly, none of them are old books, with very few exceptions. They're all been written within the last 10, 20 years. The knowledge of history, the understanding of communism, of socialism, of who a Nazi really is, they don't seem to possess those basic skills, and that's damaging too.
Yeah, you know, it's unfortunate that a lot of journalism schools don't take the model of Missouri, which is, you know, you didn't get into the journalism school until you had two thorough years of a broader education in history and economics and politics and so forth before you even got into journalism school. So it wasn't a trade school where you just learned how to be a reporter. You learned how to be a thinker. You learned you learned how to understand history and politics in a way that you could then apply the reporting to that.
That's interesting. I did not know that. But I have to say, as a radio talk show host, if somebody asks me what it takes, I would say you cannot be a young, successful, I mean, powerful, effective radio talk show host. You have to have tons of experience. You have to have tons of knowledge. You have to know what you're talking about a lot of things. And so that comports. You just don't get on the air and talk about a few articles that you read, or you don't write in that way either. You have a background, a backlog of understanding of the issue. And with that in mind, one thing that surprised me that didn't come out in the movie, Lee, was that you went to Yale Law School. I mean, you approached the whole business of the case for Christ as an attorney. I was curious, why didn't they mention that?
There's actually a real quick reference. You probably missed it because it's real easy to miss, a very quick reference to it. I think, you know, the law school thing is helpful because, you know, especially Yale Law School, because it's a philosophical law school. In other words, you don't go in and just learn what they call black letter law, which is how to apply, you know, the law in a mechanical way. You really look at philosophy, and you look at the underpinnings of the law and the whys behind it. And that really helped me as a journalist to understand law, but also I found as a Christian, because so much of Christianity can be investigated. It is an investigatable faith. It makes certain claims of history in terms of the resurrection and the Gospels and so forth that can be checked out. And I found that a lot of the skills that I learned in law school were really handy when I investigated the credibility of the Christian faith.
My guest is Lee Strobel. The book and the movie is called The Case for Christ. You can get it now. You can buy it and take it home or invite neighbors in. You can watch it on your big screen TV and watch Lee's story, because it is dramatic and powerful. And look what God has done. When we return, Lee, of course, grew up to be, then, in addition to everything else, a pastor, a theologian, an apologist. And so when we come back, I want to talk to Lee a little bit about what's going on in the world, his perspective as a man now who's studied in Scripture, who loves the Lord in a new way, and we're going to talk about what's going on in this world. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
I've spent my entire career as a journalist uncovering the truth. Until the day my wife presented me with the biggest story of my life. The Case for Christ. From that moment on, I set out to prove to her and to the rest of the world that they were wrong. And what happened next changed me. Forever.
Well, that gives me chills, because that's kind of the, in our own human way, sort of demonstrates the power of God, because that's really the way it feels inside. When God gets hold of you, you know, the orchestra swells and the timpani beats and you're never the same again. Right, Lee?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's just a teaser from the book, the movie, The Case for Christ, which we're featuring right now. And Lee Strobel, of course, is it's his story. It's what happened to him. And I met Lee back in the late 90s in Chicago when, before, I think, Lee, you became a pastor. I think you must have still been at the Chicago Tribune, I think. And we both met at a big church called Willow Creek, which, as I was reflecting on talking to you today, I thought about this, you know, you came to Willow Creek initially as a non-believer with your wife, Leslie, and then came to Christ. Here's this big mega church, Bill Hybels, the pastor. I came as a person who had come to Christ in a dramatic way when I was 9 years old, who had served the Lord, been in ministry, but had just gone through a really painful divorce, single mom, two children, going through a sad time, not doubting my faith at all, but just a sad, lonely time. And we both met or were benefited by the ministry of what I think arguably was the first mega church. Did I get that right? Were there other mega churches before Willow?
Well, yeah, there were. It was certainly one of the first, and also probably the premier, what they would call a seeker-driven church, or a church for the unchurched.
Yeah, I mean, we had as many as 20,000 people on a weekend,
yeah.
And it was huge. And, of course, you and I were there during the most powerful, I believe, some of the most powerful times of Willow Creek. The music was unbelievable, which, as I understand it, that's one of the things that drew you, right?
Oh, man, the spiritual activity, it was incredible. And, you know, you think about people, Christians who lived for 2,000 years, who've never been part of a thriving community like that, where people are coming to faith right and left, where life change is happening all around us, where people's values and character are being completely rewritten and turned upside down. And, It was a thrilling era, and I thank God that I got to be part of that.
Yeah, me too. And the other part of the experience there was just the most incredible drama, because we had professional actors. Who just performed every week vignettes that proclaimed the gospel in one form or fashion. It was just an incredible experience. But I think, I'm going to speak as a seasoned believer, and you are one now too. Looking back, I would be interested to know, Lee, what you think about that seeker-sensitive megachurch model, what you think it accomplished, what its strengths were. What do you think?
Well, it was an important model because so many people like me who were spiritual skeptics would not darken the door of a church. And yet here was a church that said, we're going to speak your language. We're not going to change our theology, but we're going to change our methodology. We're going to present through drama, through music, through a relevant scriptural message, the message of Christianity in a way that you get it. And I think that's really important. It led thousands of people to faith. Now, the downside is people need to continue to grow spiritually, and the real challenge was, how do you do that if you're turning your weekend services into more evangelistic services? Where are the Christians growing deeper in their personal relationship with God? Of course, we tried to do that through small groups and through Wednesday night services. That was a constant struggle. I think there's probably a happy medium these days where a church can adjust the dials of its weekend service just slightly to make it more amenable, more approachable by non-believers without completely doing a 180-degree turn like Willow Creek did back then.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think you described what I was going to ask you, the weaknesses, and I agree with you. I think it's the going deeper part, the doctrine, because we know that the Great Commission that Jesus gave was to preach the gospel, but it was also to teach all these things whatsoever I've commanded you. So there was a whole lot more to learn after that initial coming to Christ.
Right.
And that's the journey that we're still on. And so as you go deeper, things change and you need more. And so I guess if we're talking to people that are in that situation, we need to tell them to look for more. They need to really, really get into Scripture. One of my greatest frustrations, Lee, right now is that the Christians are so uneducated about their faith, and it causes them not to have passion and confidence about what they believe.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it, a lack of confidence, which is unfortunate because truly the Christian faith has on its side a proliferation of historical and scientific evidence that I think makes it powerful and persuasive to believe. And yet a lot of Christians know kind of that they believe, but they don't know why they believe. And as a result, our position in the culture is compromised because they're unable to articulate to other people why it is that they believe what they believe. When they can, we can build a really good case for Christianity being true. But when they get challenged, if they don't have a reservoir of understanding about why Christianity is true, and they get challenged by a friend at work or a colleague or a neighbor who is an atheist who raises some objections or some questions, it can shatter or damage their faith. It doesn't have to be that way. And I think the church, unfortunately, back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, it kind of moved away from apologetics or teaching on evidence for the faith. And that's why we have a proliferation of parachurch organizations that do this. Nowadays, the trend is for this to come back under the umbrella of the local church. And we're seeing local churches train people better in terms of why we believe what we believe. And that's a very positive development. And what's driving it are Christians who are being challenged about their faith by other people, and then they're coming to the pastor and saying, hey, you never taught us why this is logical to believe, what the evidence is. And pastors are now saying, yeah, you're right, we haven't, so let's do that. And they're adding programs, they're adding preaching, they're adding classes and seminars and so forth to try to help people understand the evidential basis for the faith.
You know, that's music to my ears, Lee. I have to say, when I was in my early 20s, I moved to Berlin, Germany, and the new Bible translations had just were just being developed. Well, I guess that started when I was probably about 16, but it wasn't until I was just before I went to Germany that I started, just had a spiritual renewal. And it's a long story, and I don't want to take our time talking about it. But I just couldn't get enough of God's word. And I ended up going to Germany thinking, you know, I was going to evangelize Germany. And what I found was that God had beat me there, and that there were Christians of every stripe, of every race, and every color. And the more I saw of the world, and the more I have experienced it, and the more I have learned of him and of Scripture, the deeper my faith has grown, the deeper, the more powerful. It's, there's nothing to be afraid of. And I'm sure, Lee, you must have, I know you discovered this. You can ask any question. Nothing is off limits to ask.
Yeah, that's exactly true. In fact, I did a book called The Case for Faith, and I did a national survey and asked people, if you could ask God any one question and you knew he would give you an answer right now, what would you ask him? And I took the results of that survey and took the top 8 objections and questions that people had, and I went around to scholars and experts and interviewed them about answers to those questions. And you know what? There are good answers. You know, and sometimes we shrink back because we're not sure. Maybe we've discovered the question that's going to shatter Christianity, when the truth is there are good answers to the toughest questions of life and faith.
You know, before I ask you the next question, speaking of questions, where could people get your books, Lee?
Boy, anywhere. They're available. My website, leestrobel.com, lists them, and anywhere books are available.
And what was the name of the book you just mentioned?
The Case for Faith.
Case for Faith. Okay.
Right.
Because people will want to know that. All right. You know, Lee, every day I cover the news, and I tried to get away. I was just in Scotland with my kids, my son and his family. I tried not to look, but it was hard not to, because, you know, the headlines shout all over the globe what's going on. And all over the globe, we, you know, we have what happened in Spain, and we have what's happening in the Middle East and Afghanistan, and we have what's happening in Charlottesville, and we have what's happening in public schools, and what's happening probably, you know, we could go on and on with the things that we see unraveling worldwide. And as you look at that, as a Christian and as a man who has made it his business to ask questions, what do you say, first of all, to believers as they look at this chaos? What do you say to them by way of giving them perspective as a follower of Jesus?
You know, I want to use that word that you used earlier, which is confidence, that we should have a confident faith. That we, as we look at a world that's unraveling, as we look at the challenges around the globe, as we look at the moral deterioration of our culture, as we look at the challenges of radical Islamic terrorism, we need to have confidence that our faith in Jesus Christ is well-placed, and it's supported by strong evidence that gives us that confidence, and that with that, knowing that it is true, that it's not just a belief that we believe because we know in our hearts it can't be true, but it is really based on a solid foundation of evidence and facts and logic and data, I think that gives us courage. And you know, Jesus said, you know, in this world, you're going to have trouble. A lot of religious leaders don't say that. They say that suffering is maya or illusion, the Eastern religions. It's an illusion. It's not real. No, it is real. And Jesus was honest with us. He said, in this world, you will have trouble. Why? Because we live in a sin-stained world. But he said, take courage. I have overcome the world. And so we need to take courage, because he has overcome the world. He has, through his death and resurrection, shown that he is the unique Son of God. And if Jesus is who he claimed to be, we really have nothing to fear about the future.
I agree. It's hard to explain it sometimes. You know, Lee, when I was in China, well, because I've been to so many countries talking with persecuted believers, undergoing serious persecution. I was in North Korea also. It's just unbelievable the things that people are facing. But the thing I saw was that these believers, the universal thing that I saw was they would say, you know, once I stopped being afraid, I was so filled with joy. And I saw firsthand that they were tasting of God in a more intimate way, and of his power, of more of his power. I got a glimpse of it. And I saw it, and I know that the same Spirit that raised Christ Jesus and who transformed your life, transformed my life, is going to fill us with that power. We're going to see more of him, and we're going to experience so much more of the Spirit that we won't ever want to go back to the way it was when things were easy. And that, in an odd way, gives me confidence, but it's hard to explain that.
Yeah, it is. It reminds me of Eastern Europe during communism, where the church was persecuted. And one pastor said, you know, the church is like a nail. He said, the harder you hit us, the deeper we go. And, you know, the church does suffer persecution around the world. Christians are the most persecuted group in the world. But it means we go deeper. And through going deeper, we gather the courage and the fortitude through Jesus to take that next step. And I think the witness of that church is inspirational to the world at large.
All right. Lee Strobel, thank you. It's been a pleasure. I knew it would be, and it has been. The book is called...
Thanks, Sandy. So great chatting with you.
Yeah, the book is called The Case for Christ. You can still get the book, of course, but the movie is now available for your purchase, The Case for Christ, the story of Lee Strobel and his beautiful wife, Leslie. Their beautiful story of how God called them, changed their lives, and now the rest of the world is benefiting from all that Lee has written with all the things that God has done in his life. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.